I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday. If you're hosting this year's Thanksgiving dinner, I'm guessing that you expect your guests to show up with some sort of side dishes, right? Or maybe you're one of those guests who's volunteered to bring a dish. And now you're worried. You're thinking about gluey, gunky mashed potatoes or whether those taut cranberries will turn into a jelly-like sauce. Well, have no fear. SciFry is here with our latest episode of Food Failures, exploring the science behind Thanksgiving sides like mashed potatoes, cranberry sauce, gravy. We're even going to throw in some turkey tips. So here to help us with selected short subjects and sides is Julie Yu, who describes the kitchen as simply a laboratory, which you're allowed to eat. I like that. She's a staff scientist and director of the Teacher Institute at the Exploratorium in San Francisco, California. She joins us from KQED. Welcome to the program, Julie.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
Oh,
it's a pleasure to be here.
You're so welcome. Why is Thanksgiving your favorite holiday, especially from the standpoint of your interest in food and science?
Well, I have a lifetime of training and studying science and a lifetime of eating, and Thanksgiving is the perfect day to bring those two things together.
Well, let's just jump right into it, so to speak, and into the gravy. What's the main challenge with making gravy?
Well, I think, you know, the story of gravy is really a story of getting along. And, you really just need the oily parts of the pan drippings and the watery parts of the pan drippings to get along in an emulsion. And you want to do it in this nice heterogeneous way to avoid lumps. And So what really needs to happen is the flavor components that dissolve best in the oil parts and the flavor components that dissolve best in the liquid parts need to come together. And you usually do that by adding a thickener like flour and the proteins that are in the flour and also in some stock that you add, bring them together in an emulsion. And the way you prevent lumps, which is kind of the tragedy to many people of gravies, is to mix the flour thoroughly into the fat layer of, you know, you put some of the fatty parts of your pan drippings in the pot and you make a little roux with the flour. And you want that thoroughly mixed so that when you add in the liquid, whether it's stock or wine or something else, that it comes together in this nice homogeneous viscous fluid.
Mm-hmm. And so you really want to get the oil and the water to mix in your gravy, and that's a hard thing to do.
That's right.
Yeah. Flour, as you say, what role does that play in making the gravy?
So flour provides the starch that thickens the whole liquid up. It also has some proteins, and proteins are kind of like the molecules that can reach across the aisle. They have some components that love to grab onto the water molecules and some components that love to grab onto the oil molecules. So they can kind of hold the two things that typically don't bind together. And flour gives you the nice consistency that you want. Those starch molecules absorb whatever liquid that you have that you've added to your gravy. And, you know, you can dial it in as it heats up. The starch molecules will thicken it to the consistency that you want. So the tip for flour and consistency is as your gravy cools, once you bring it to the table, the gravy is going to thicken. So you want to make sure that your gravy is thinner on the stove than you want it to be on your table.
Does cornstarch do the same thing?
Cornstarch does the same thing. Cornstarch has different types of starch molecules. It's biased towards ones that don't absorb as much water, and also cornstarch has way less protein than flour does. So you typically make a little slurry of cornstarch, but the thickening and the starch it behaves the same way.
Mm-hmm. Our number 844-724-8255. If you've had a Thanksgiving disaster, we're here to help you. Send us a question, call in. You can also tweet us at SciFry, SciFri. What about adding wine to some of the recipes, even your gravy recipe? What does that do to it?
So again, one of the tricks is getting the flavor molecules that come off in your drippings to dissolve into the liquid form. And some of those dissolve in oil and some dissolve in water and some actually dissolve best in alcohol. So adding wine gives you a little bit of alcohol to better dissolve those molecules. And of course, wine adds a wonderful flavor to gravy, and the alcohol eventually boils off. But all of the molecules have come off the pan and are mixed into your sauce. But, if you really want to improve the flavor of your gravy, A handful of years ago, the Royal Society of Chemistry actually did some research to figure out the secret ingredient to the best gravy. And coincidentally,
drum roll,
it's
please.
Actually, I'm sorry?
Oh, yeah,
it's actually, it's a family secret for me. It's the way my mom made gravy for decades. And my mom and the Royal Society of Chemistry came up with the same solution, which is that the secret of good gravy is a little soy sauce.
Really?
You know, my mom just had it at arm's reach, but the Royal Society discovered that the glutamates that are in soy sauce really bring out the umami compounds, the savory components of pan drippings.
Oh, so you couldn't add a little MSG instead?
You absolutely could. That's another way to get at it. So the glutamates and MSG and the glutamates and soy sauce are very closely related.
Mm-hmm. Let's switch gears to another wonderful side dish topic, and that's cranberry sauce. Tell us what happens when you make cranberry sauce and how that gel is created.
Yeah, so cranberry sauce is just a form of fruit preserves, and it's probably one of the easiest things to make because all you need are cranberries, sugar, and water. And when you heat those things together, the cranberries start to open, and there are molecules inside that are kind of related to starches. They're pectin molecules. They're kind of long-chain polymers of sugars. And pectin in a plant plays a role in providing structure to the plant's cell wall, but the pectin kind of gets released as the cranberries get cooked and it dissolves in the water. And they can, it can form a network. Like if you just think of this long stringy mesh, you really want the pectin molecules to come together in a web. And there are three key things that happen to encourage it to do that. One is as the pectin dissolves, they actually come off with a negative charge. They're electrically charged. And so since they're all negative, they repel each other, but you want them to come together. And so the way to encourage them to come together is first to add sugar, because sugar will draw away some of the water, kind of forcing all the pectin molecules to come together. Another thing that you typically do when making fruit preserves is to add an acid, and those neutralize negative charges, also encouraging the molecules to come together, actually just discouraging them from repelling each other. Cranberries are pretty naturally high in both pectin and acid, so they have this built in. And finally, You cook everything together to have it bubbling away so that some of the water boils away, increasing the concentration of the pectin. And the end result is this network of a jelly-like substance that traps all the little bits of cranberry and flavor inside.
Hmm. So you have to have, once again, you have to have the right ratio of all these ingredients for all that chemistry to happen.
That's right. And a fun thing to do at home while you're experimenting in the kitchen is to see what matters. You have the component of time, how long you cook, which is directly related to how much pectin is released into the liquid. So if you like a thinner cranberry sauce with whole chunks of cranberry, you would cook it for a little less time and less pectin would be released. If you like that really thick gelatin cranberry sauce that you can literally cut with a knife, you want to just keep boiling it away as the water evaporates off, more and more pectin is released. You'll get this nice solid mass that you can mold into whatever shape you want. Just pour it into the mold when it's hot, and then when it's cool, it will be jellified.
Wow, jellified. Our number, 844-724-8255. Dave in Reno, are you jellified, Dave?
I was actually going to ask about emulsifiers.
Okay.
I've been using xanthan gum for emulsification and a few things lately, and I was wondering if that would be a good additive for gravy?
I think you should try it out and see. I think the proteins that are naturally in gravy, so the proteins that come off of the turkey into the drippings, and the proteins that are, you know, especially if you're using stock that has gelatin in it, those proteins are typically enough to give you this nice thick gravy. You usually don't want it to be too thick or, you know, too solid. But if you're a vegetarian and maybe you didn't take out pan drippings and you're making this from scratch and you're just trying to get some nice oil to mix with some nice liquid, a little dash of soy sauce and xanthan gum will probably get you there.
Hmm. Let's move on to mashed potatoes, because that's what everybody has. What's the best way to mash a potato?
My preferred way is to pass the potato through a ricer. And the challenge of mashing potatoes and actually just cooking potatoes is, you know, as the potatoes cook, the key player in the potato are these starch granules that are inside. And That starch does not dissolve in cold water, but as you raise the temperature, the starch starts to absorb water. And you want to basically break up the cells of a potato without releasing too much of that starch. And so doing it kind of mechanically with your hand, either with a masher or with a ricer, allows you to break it up without over breaking it up. Because if you throw it then in a food processor or a blender, just the amount of contact with those mechanical blades and kind of the force at which they bust up the cells, a lot of the starch gets released and you end up with this gluey mass of potato gum.
You're making paper mache paste, in other words.
Exactly, yeah. That's another way to do it. You can turn it into an art project instead.
But does an electric mixer have any benefits? Or, you know, because there's always the great debate in making mashed potatoes. Some people like it really smooth. Some people like it hand lumpy, right?
You're right. I mean, so there's the lumpy, smooth debate, and there's also kind of like a dry and fluffy potato versus kind of a creamy, more potato puree path you want to take. And so, indeed, if you prefer like a creamy, it's probably more European, kind of a French-style potato where there's almost as much butter as potato, you might choose like a waxier Yukon Gold potato that actually has less starch in it. So those take a lot of we actually use them because they hold their shape. But in mashed potatoes, of course, you want them to not hold their shape. And so you have to physically mash them a lot. So I might be tempted to use maybe a stand mixer, but I wouldn't go so far as a food processor because those things are pretty brutal.
Mm. Yeah. But, you know, potatoes are cheap. You can experiment a lot with mashed potatoes.
That's right.
You can make something for everybody. Let's talk a little bit about turkeys, because it is Thanksgiving and everybody talks turkey during Thanksgiving. I want to ask you, is it an old wives' tale that the tryptophan in turkey makes us tired? It's a natural sleeping ingredient?
Yes. I think that's a myth that continues to be perpetuated. I've certainly heard it. I may have even said it at one point that tryptophan in turkey makes you sleepy, and it is true that turkey has tryptophan, and it is also true that a large amount of tryptophan intake can make you sleepy. What's not true is that turkey has like an excessively large amount of tryptophan. It actually has the same amount of tryptophan levels as other poultry and other meats, and actually other high protein foods like nuts and seeds. And so you never see, you know, someone eating a bunch of sunflower seeds at the baseball game and feeling sleepy afterwards, even though they probably took more tryptophan than you would at a normal Thanksgiving dinner. So it's actually not the tryptophan in turkey that makes you sleepy. But of course, many of us who have had a large Thanksgiving meal have experienced wanting to sleep afterwards. And the reason that happens is actually just the sheer amount of food that we're eating. Like, you can think about all of these sides that we're talking about, and you can rack up the calories pretty quickly.
Right.
And all three of the sides that we talked about, actually, you know, carbohydrates play an important role. And we take in a large amount of carbohydrates, and your body, actually, your biological systems kind of, they shift when you have a large intake of carbohydrates in your gastrointestinal tract. Your nervous system shifts to kind of focus all your energies into digestion. And the counterbalance to this is to create a blast of melatonin in your brain to make you feel sleepy so that you do nothing else other than digest.
Wait for the message. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And the scientific word for that is?
Scientists call that postprandial somnolence. But
one more time?
Most people, postprandial somnolence. So it's kind of after a big meal, you get sleepy. So most people actually know this phenomenon, but we commonly call it food coma. Really what's happening is you're eating so much and you want to take a nap.
Yeah. Anything else we should know about the chemistry of cooking a turkey that you could share with us, sir?
Just to realize that, you know, many of us don't cook turkey very often. It's a once or twice a year thing. And many of us cook chickens a lot. Like, I've probably cooked more chickens this year than I've cooked turkeys in my life. So we don't get a lot of chances in terms of experimentation. We don't get a lot of chances to get it right. And there is a size and scale issue. The turkeys that you're cooking are usually much larger than the chickens that you're cooking. So you have to kind of calibrate your cooking techniques and methods to accommodate for that.
And, of course, we're always told that don't undercook the turkey, right? It could be dangerous not to let the temperature rise high enough.
Yeah, I think in general, with poultry and meats, there's a generally recognized safe temperature that the FDA states that your poultry needs to be cooked to. It's different for light meat and dark meat,
right,
because of the components, what those things are made of. And so one great strategy is actually to cook those things separately and to treat them each as two different types of meat, which they kind of are, even though they're all turkey. And so if you can forego the Norman Rockwell photo opportunity of carving the nice bird at the end of the Thanksgiving table, you might be better off pre-carving your turkey and then cooking those pieces separately, or at least at different times.
What is your top turkey tip for this year?
I am a big fan of brining the turkey ahead of time. I think that it's a technique that's become a little more popular in recent years, but the advantage of brining is, as long as you prepare ahead of time with enough time, you can get the turkey to take up salt and water kind of in the extracellular areas of the turkey muscle, and that protects you against having your turkey be too dry because you've actually added water to the situation. And also it helps the turkey cook faster. It essentially kind of increases the heat transfer within the turkey, so you can get the whole turkey to cook in a shorter amount of time, which also increases your chances of not having it dry out. It's such a large mass of meat, so much larger than all the other meat you probably cook, that you want the heat transfer to occur as quickly as possible. That's why frying turkeys is actually really popular, because you can cook it in a short amount of time. They end up very moist.
Everything you wanted to know about Thanksgiving. Julie Yu, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, and have a happy Thanksgiving.
You too. Dr. Yu is a staff scientist and director of the Teacher Institute. That's at the famous Exploratorium in San Francisco.